Dr. Oscar Howe, a graduate of Morehead State, and now Professor Emeritus of English Education at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas. Let's begin by having a little autobiography, where you came from, how you got here.
Okay. I was born very, very far north. I was almost a Canadian. Born in Hellock, Minnesota, and lived there for the first 7 years of my life, finishing the first grade, and then moving on to Hawley, Minnesota, where I lived during the time that I was in the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grades. I then moved up to Kitson County, to Donelson, Minnesota, where I went to school for 3 years, and then on up to Badger, Minnesota, south of Lake of the Woods, where I graduated from a small high school in 1925. I was only 16 at the time. Pushed along in those days, they had what you call acceleration programs, and I guess to keep me out of mischief, I went through the 5th, 6th, and 7th, and 8th grades in 2 years, and that's how it happened that I entered school here at the age of 16, a little bit young for the rest of my classmates at that time.
Well, let's take a look at the campus as it looked when you first arrived.
It was, to me, a very, very large campus, although it's small by comparison now. There were four buildings, two dormitories. Let's see, Wheeler and Comstock were their names. And then the Old Main, which I thought extended surely a full city block. It seemed like such a big building to such a youngster who came from a small town in northern Minnesota. And then the new building with that magnificent stage, Weld Hall.
Let's think about Weld Hall for a moment. What went on in Weld Hall Auditorium?
Oh, goodness sakes. I have many, many pleasant memories of Weld Hall, and now as a member of an elder hostel class which meets there, I recall a number of things about Weld Hall. One of them was we always went there to chapel. They had a chapel exercise, as I recall, once a week, and we were assigned seats, and somebody came around and made a little note as to which seats were empty, and those people, of course, were promptly identified, and absence was explainable to the dean of men or dean of women. We found those chapel exercises very interesting, though. There was always something of a religious nature in them, something educational, also something of a cultural nature. We did a lot of singing. I remember we used to sing a song there called Sing Along the Way, and everybody seemed to love to sing it, too, and they sang it at almost every meeting with great gusto. The faculty sat on the stage, and the president right in the center, back of a podium, and he would, of course, lead the proceedings, as it were. The faculty also, right in back of him or alongside of him, with all of the department chairmen in the first line, and then decreasingly backwards. So the newest faculty sat in the back row. The students, of course, were only about 500 to 600 in number, and there were enough seats in Weld Hall to accommodate them all. That was one of my fond memories.
Let me ask you something about
that chapel
program. To what extent was it religious?
Well, it was, I suppose the word hadn't been invented, but it was an experience of ecumenicity.
Uh-huh. Lutheran students and a congregational president.
Yes, Ray McLean was the president at that time, and he would oftentimes give us little excerpts from things. I remember one day he was very, very eloquent when he read a poem that went something like, "It is the set of the sail and not the gale that tells where the ship will go." And, of course, that was the substance of the idea of the paths that you were to choose and so on. It was inspirational of that type. Occasionally, there would be scripture readings, but it was non-denominational in the truest sense of the word, yes.
All right, let's get back to the stage at Weld Hall. What else went on there?
Well, Weld Hall was a place where I was most interested because Ethel Tainter was the director of dramatics, and I had been in her class called Reading and Interpretation, I think it was. Reading and Speech, it was the name of that course. And that was the equivalent of Speech 1 in most colleges today. I found her a fascinating person. I learned many, many important things. I'd always interested in drama, and she had me in the first play that was produced, Percy Mackay's Joan of Arc. And I recall the experiences there with great, great interest. One of the things, a little detail you may be interested in, Maud Hayes was then the chairman of the Department of Language and Literature. And there's a big question, how do you pronounce that name? Is it Percy MacKay or is it Percy MacKay or however? And so Maud wrote to him and asked him that question, how do you pronounce your name? And he wrote back a little poem, and as I recall, it ended up something like, and this is the reason why they call me Percy MacKay.
Uh-huh.
It was a splendid opportunity to appear with a great number of good people. I remember Helen Berquist played the part of Joan of Arc, and she was a stocky blonde who was, well, I should say better fed than Joan of Arc was, if I remember Joan of Arc from history, but a beautiful voice. She was a wonderful contralto singer and a fine speaker. A young, tall, handsome boy by the name of Adolphe Resquez played the part of Duc d'Alençon, and they made a great team. I took a part, I think I was the Bishop of Beauvais, or something of that sort. My next year, we put on Taming the Shrew, and it was Frank Nemzik, brother of the great Sliv, who was our Petruchio, and we had a little Irish girl named Delia O'Neill, who was Kate, and they were a great pair. I remember my part, Tranio. I still recite some of the lines from time to time as well, you know. And we had a tremendous costuming situation. I think they came down from a Minneapolis costuming house, and I think it cost us the magnificent sum of $500 to rent the costumes for that performance. I also appeared in other things like the Glee Club and so on, and I remember once I took a part in an Indian drama, and I had to do an Indian dance and sing an Indian song. Uh-huh. So Old Hall has many memories, dramatically speaking, for me. Yes, sir.
All right, drama. You mentioned the Glee Club. Are you talking about the name of a play, or are you talking about an organization?
No, the Glee Club was the men's Glee Club. Dan Preston was director, and there weren't too many fellas around, so competition wasn't that tough, or I wouldn't have made it, I'm sure, because I'd never had a music lesson in my life. Mm-hmm. But I loved to sing, and Preston seemed to sense that, and we used to sing barbershop harmony, as it were, and it wasn't long before I was a member of the Glee Club. I had some good friends in the group. I was with it for the full 2 years I was here, and I enjoyed it very much, to the extent that Dan asked me, he said, well, now, he said, if you boys really want to learn music, you've got to come over and sing in my church choir. So I sang every Sunday morning over in the Congregational Church Choir, where the Reverend Mr. Dr. Errington was the pastor. And that was another great experience, too, and especially singing with Dan Preston. I think maybe one of the things that I should mention here is we were required to take a class in music.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the basic requirements. We also had to take a class in art, and Dan taught this class in music almost as if it were a class in ear training. And remember, I hadn't had a music lesson in my life, and I didn't particularly succeed when it came to ear training because I couldn't transpose from a major key to a minor key and come out even, as it were. But I think maybe he stretched it a bit because I worked so hard in the Glee Club and tried so hard, and I managed to get a C out of my music course all right.
Uh-huh. All right, what other musical organizations do you remember from the campus or the town? Was music very much a part of life?
Well,
you said they sang in chapel with a good deal of gusto.
Yes. The girls' organization was an excellent one, of course, because they had so many more girls than boys. As I have mentioned, there were a small number of fellows on the campus at that time. I don't know how many. It must have been around 70, 75, I would guess. There were probably 500 girls, and as I say, the ratio of that many girls to that number of fellows made it very convenient. You were never without a date, and it was just a wonderful experience to be a member of that kind of a minority group. But the girls had a great choir because there were, as I say, so many of them, and they were all training to be teachers. That was the prevailing program at that time, and many of them were gifted singers, and so the girls' group was great. The college had an orchestra, too, and I remember Dan played the violin, and Mrs. Preston also participated with the violin, and other students participated. They had a band. I think Professor Christensen directed the band, but Dan Preston directed the men's chorus and the women's chorus, and as I recall, he also was the leader of this orchestra group, which was interesting because there weren't too many orchestras as such in the two cities at that particular time. As far as music was concerned, I would say that probably the chief musical culture that came to the community in that period of time was largely the result of things like the Arts Festival that was held in the spring. I remember one spring, the Arts Festival of my senior year, or then my second year, particularly in 1927, because Maud Hayes, who was then the chairman of the Department of Language and Literature, had arranged for a fine program. We had a soprano from Chicago and a young baritone from New York, and the climax of the whole thing was the Little Symphony from New York. And I recall George Barrar was a conductor because he is rather renowned as a flutist, and we prevailed upon him to play a flute solo at the end that night, and he said, now don't tell anybody I did this because my agent will want to charge you extra for it. Well, that's a picture of the kind of thing that went on. In connection with that arts festival, too, I should tell you, there was a very interesting art exhibit. It was imported, as it were, and Miss McCartan, who was head of the art department, was in charge of that, and I knew this because I was the business manager, the student business manager, and did a great deal of the legwork that was required to make all of this possible.
Let's take a little closer look at the student body, and I guess through you. You came from Badger High School.
That's right.
Not a very large class. How large?
Oh, my graduating class, I suppose, is 15, 16 or so, and my high school around 70 to 80.
What number of students went on to college?
A small number. I don't recall specifics, but probably only two or three out of a senior class would go on to college. Most of them stayed in the community to work with Dad on the farm or in the local store or something of the sort. I remember particularly that some of the athletes who were capable, I remember the fellow who came in the next class went to the University of Illinois because that area up there in northern Minnesota was quite strong baseball territory, and he had a scholarship at the University of Illinois, but they were definitely a small group.
All right, so you came here with 400 or 500 women, 70 to 80 men.
Yes.
Students who came, I suppose most of them like you, from small towns.
That's right.
And among the few who went on to college. Were there many students from North Dakota here then?
I don't recall that, except to say that I mentioned the play, Joan of Arc. It seems to me that Helen Berquist was from Fargo, North Dakota, and they attracted a number of, the college at that time attracted a number of the fine students from North Dakota, especially if they wanted to do work in music or things like that. I think there was a very vigorous kind of a advertising on the part of the faculty and so on to bring students to the campus because they needed the enrollment, and it was a growing institution, and they wanted it to grow. But there were, yes, a fair number of students from Fargo and a considerable number from Moorhead.
Mm-hmm.
I think we got a great number of fine athletes from the Moorhead High School as well as from Detroit Lakes and schools in this immediate area.
Right. Now, you mentioned the dormitories for women, which there were two. The young men were on their own, I take it.
Yes, that's right. I lived in a house at, I still remember the address, 1022 Fifth Avenue South, and I was over there the other day looking at my old stamping ground, and my wife, who's with me at the Elder Hostel now, went along with me, and I was standing outside looking at this old house, and the man came out and said, "Do you want to buy it?" And I said, "Well, no, I probably should if I were wealthy enough, keep it as a shrine, you know." But I told him I lived up there. I remember that window. That was.
Is there a for sale sign on that
house? No, it wasn't at the time, although I think he's interested in selling it if he can get his price.
There is one in that block, I know, that is for sale.
Well, the interesting thing was that Moorhead State Teachers College had rented really the upstairs, as it were. I had a single room. And I guess it was because I wanted to be alone so I could study. And I was very busy because I was working every spare minute at trying to make money to put myself through college. And then there was a room adjacent to mine that was quite a bit larger, and three fellows stayed in there. And then there was another room a little bit farther down, somewhat smaller, where there were two. So there were six of us who were students at Moorhead State at that time. and we all ate together at a little house down the street, a Mrs. Miller, I think, Miller was her name, that's right, Evelyn Miller. And her daughter, I think, was a teacher at Moorhead High School, and the mother ran the boarding house for college boys. And we six ate there, plus some of the other fellows. I think there were 10 or 11 around the table.
Uh-huh.
$5.50 a week for 20 meals, by the way.
All right, the 20 meals suggest that you didn't spend many weekends going home. Of course, you came from a long way off.
That's right.
There must have been quite a number of students who didn't go home for weekends. What happened on the weekend?
Well, I think, of course, many of them were much closer than I was. I was from the Lake of the Woods territory, and that was a half day's ride by train, mm-hmm. and it was an expensive trip, too. I remember spending my Thanksgiving vacations here working at different things. I remember once Dr. Leisure, who was then head of Buildings and Grounds and Industrial Arts, had a job of painting the boiler room. And he offered me 35 cents an hour to spend my Thanksgiving weekend doing that. And I came out of there grimy, but a little bit richer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, as far as I was concerned, I stayed here and worked every chance I got. My summers I didn't spend here, however.
All right, let's say it's Saturday night, the great Saturday night of the Midwest in the 1920s and
uh-huh.
30s. Maybe 200 college women who didn't go home that weekend, and maybe 40 college men. What did you do on a Saturday night?
Oh, many times they had college parties.
Uh-huh.
And I recall we had a wonderful dance orchestra at that time. We had a fellow by the name of Malvey who played in it, and Strombo who played the drums. And incidentally, Hod Eklund, who still is around these parts,
right.
was a fine musician, and he was in that dance band. So we oftentimes had parties in the old gym, and they were dancing parties, and then they would always close up at 12, you know, and we'd get the girls back to the dormitories for closing hours, and that was a very common thing. It was true also that sometimes we went to the movies, you know. There was a motion picture house here in Moorhead, but most of the movie going was at Fargo.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, we had a streetcar line
right.
that went from downtown Fargo, well, the outskirts of Fargo, and it ended up here on the Moorhead State campus, and of course it was our yellow cab. So we used to take the streetcar to Fargo and oftentimes take in a movie of a Saturday night and always get back in plenty of time so the girls didn't get into any late entering troubles.
North Dakota, including Fargo, has always had a reputation for Saturday night dances. That's the Lawrence Welk
yes,
origins and
true.
So on. And in Fargo, I understand there were dance halls of some renown. Did you ever get to those?
Yes, there was one over there. I don't remember what it was called.
Was a Crystal Ballroom around at that time?
I don't remember if that was the name of it, but there was one of those dance halls. We didn't find a need for frequenting them for a couple of reasons. One being that it was kind of expensive. I think they charge you 50 cents or more to get in, and sometimes you'd rather spend a buck because it was cheaper to go to the movies. And then also, if we had fine dances in the campus here, why, there certainly wasn't any need to go over to a dance in Fargo. We went to a few, but they were relatively, in my case at least, they were relatively few and far between. I got most of my entertainment right here at home, and it was great.
Were most of the women willing to come to the parties without an escort?
Well, a lot of them had to, of course,
yes.
because there was a shortage of fellows. Although there were many boys about town in Moorhead who liked to date the girls, and many of their boyfriends came up from their hometowns, and they were admitted, too, if they were properly vouched for. But I suppose, to be honest, there were a great number of them who, shall we say, were not going because they didn't have an escort, or many of them who did go found that they weren't as active as they'd like to be, as you can well understand.
Right. You hit the public about the same time as the Model A Ford with the rumble seat. Didn't have cars. Very many students have cars.
No, that was the situation. There wasn't any parking problem because students didn't have cars, at least most of them that I knew. Oh, some of the Moorhead kids would be able to get their dad's cars mm-hmm. and take the gals out. Now, in my case, of course, I had no car. I was so far away from getting one, there was just no thought of it. But on an occasion where the sororities would give a formal party. And obviously you didn't walk a girl in a gown to something like that, so you had to take a taxi.
Uh-huh.
And it was a kind of an expensive thing to buy the corsage for the girl and to take the taxi and get it over to the place that you were going and then take her home in the taxi too. Sometimes I walked home from her house rather than take a taxi back because I couldn't afford it.
Well, we talk about the Roaring Twenties, and they roared in different ways in different places, but let me ask you about one aspect of it. This is Prohibition.
Yes.
And Prohibition, of course, is a very bad name, and everybody assumes that the young people particularly didn't pay any attention to it. What's your memory of the incidence of drinking? Now, that's a problem, of course, that our campuses are dealing with now in a formal way.
I was not particularly aware of any degree of it, although I'm sure there was some. I'm certain that there were times that boys would sneak a drink, you know, out in the hallway or something that sort. I recall on one occasion that one of the boys swears to this day that he spiked the punch at a formal party with a pint of gin, and that the Dean of Women on that particular occasion was supposed to have said, "My, this is the best punch I have ever tasted." But how true this may be, I do not know, but it was a kind of a story that bounced around. No, there wasn't much evidence of the drinking problem, at least on campus, and it certainly was frowned upon. I think that at all of our dances that we had, a number of faculty attended. Uh-huh. And I have a hunch that the way that they circulated, especially the men faculty, like Herbert Berge, who was a professor of geography and loved to dance himself, and the girls loved to dance with him too, and you can well see why. He was a splendid person. I suppose if he had noticed that anyone were imbibing, that he would have been ushered out very promptly and probably would have been answering to the Dean of Men before the evening was much, much older.
Do you remember any kind of conflict that students had with their homes in the college? In the 1920s and even into the 30s and I think into the 40s, a number of students who went off to college came from homes where dancing was strongly disapproved of. I think in this part of the country, in small towns, mm-hmm. as many as half the kids weren't allowed to dance. They came to college. Did they not dance, or did they learn to dance, or didn't they come here?
I wasn't acquainted with many who were in that particular category. I had always loved to dance myself. I liked it very much, and I tell you, when I was in high school one year, and I was a senior, we were not allowed to dance because if we were going to play basketball, we were supposed to save our legs. And the idea was that you had to conserve your energy. You could only eat certain kinds of food. No fried foods, for example, were we allowed. And it was a vigorous kind of training that we participated in. But I remember that at the end of the basketball season, they used to have dances after the games. And I remember at that particular time, they had a dance after our final basketball game. And I danced 24 straight dances without a hitch, and I would have grabbed the 25th if there'd been a girl around. I was in wonderful shape. So in that particular community in northern Minnesota, there was a good deal of that sort of thing. And I didn't notice that there was a great deal of frowning upon dancing. Now, there might have been in certain groups, but I wasn't aware of it, and it seemed that as far as the college girls were concerned, why, they were just great dancers in those mm-hmm. days, and I loved every minute of it. Maybe I just wasn't aware of the situation.
Well, let's take another look at the student body in terms of what it was doing here. Shortly before you arrived on campus, Morehead Normal School became Morehead State Teachers College.
That's right.
And that led to a four-year program
for the preparation
of high school mm-hmm. teachers. When you came, let's talk about you yourself. And what led you from Badger to Morehead State and on to become a professor of English education?
Okay. This may be a little bit much longer as a kind of a discourse, but you've asked me to tell a story that, of course, has consumed a lifetime.
Yes.
It was a case of coming to Morehead State Teachers College in 1925 for a couple of reasons. One, it was a strong family interest. My oldest sister had been enrolled here and graduated in 1915 when Frank Weld was the president. And incidentally, when she died, we were looking over a number of her things, and I found that she had a reference, a kind of a letter of recommendation personally from Frank Well, the president, about her as a teacher and an employee in the public schools. I think there's a little story there because it shows a tremendous amount of personal interest that people had, and the school was small, and even the president had time to write an individual recommendation for a student like that. My two other sisters who followed her shortly thereafter were also students here, and then they went out into teaching. And then my other sister, who was a year older than I was, but 2 years ahead of me, was a student here. And so it was quite natural, having four sisters who were students at Moorhead, for me to come to Moorhead. Now, I came here in 1925 fully intending to take a full four-year program. But at the end of 2 years, I discovered...
May I interrupt and ask you, yes, what did you plan to major in when you came?
Well, I think probably it was English. Uh-huh. I think this was my favorite subject in high school, and I would have probably leaned in the direction of this type of a major. And I was thinking in terms of a four-year program, and Dr. Archer, who was my advisor, encouraged me to do this and said, well, you're only 16, and you'll be 20 when you get out, and then you can teach in high school. But by the end of my first year, I was beginning to feel short of cash, and I'd already encountered some debts. And so I switched my program so that I could take student teaching during my second year, which I did. And then in my final quarter, I picked up whatever was required through electives and so on. So I got an advanced diploma. And in 1927, then, I was eligible to teach in the 7th and 8th grades.
Were most of the students then taking the two-year?
The two-year program was the program, obviously, of 90%. And there were a few who were able to graduate early, in a sense, because they had finished 2 years and came back to start the program in 1925 as juniors. Uh-huh. And I think it was probably in about 1927 or around there that the first members of the four-year program were graduated, although they weren't here, as shall we say, in a straight four-year program all that time.
Well, let's get back to you now.
Yes.
You graduated then in 27.
In 27, and I was very fortunate in getting a job at Campbell, Minnesota, teaching the 7th and 8th grades in a small little town of about 600 people. And I should say that I was very well prepared to fill that job and got along very, very well. Was reelected and would have returned, I think, but an opportunity came up to go to White Bear Lake, which was a suburb of St. Paul, a much larger community, and a much bigger salary. Mm-hmm. The magnificent salary of $125 a month at White Bear was quite a bit more than the $107 that I was getting at Campbell. I went to White Bear then and taught in the grade school there in the upper grades. And during that time, I went to school in the evenings at the University of Minnesota Evening School Program and in summers. And during the first 3 years at White Bear, I finished up two full years of college work on the side, as it were, and then got a bachelor's degree. I continued in the White Bear schools. I taught later in the high school there. Then I went on to teach in St. Paul, where I was chairman of the English department in the experimental, then the experimental school in the city, went away to war, and during the time that I was in the CBI, I was asked, or I should say commandeered by my commanding officer, Colonel Mandelbaum, to teach a couple of hours a week at the University of Calcutta. And that was nice because then I could be in town at least Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and then I was circulating around the rest of the theater the rest of the time. After coming back from the war, I taught another year in St. Paul and then got a job up at Wisconsin State University in Superior, Wisconsin. I taught there from 46 to 50 and realized then that while I'd had my master's degree in 1940, picking that up on the side too, I realized then that you had to have that doctor's degree or else, and discovered that I'd put in so much time in evenings and summer schools that I had all of the requirements practically except the exams, the languages, and the dissertation. So I cleaned that up and got a doctor's degree in 50, and then was invited to join the faculty at the University of Kansas, where I was part-time in the English department and part-time in the School of Education, developing a new program. It was a program in what was called English education. Mm-hmm. And I worked at that from 50 until I retired 29 years later.
All right, now, I would like to think that what happened to you at Moorhead State led to getting that Ph.D.
Oh, there's no question about it. I should tell you that there are many wonderful things that happened to me here. I think I learned some good study habits. I certainly learned how to get along with people. I learned how to budget my time. And that was one of the first things they taught us in this psychology class. We had a little project in which we had to prepare a kind of a budget of time. It was in our psychology class. And I thought at the time that it was busy work and all that sort of thing. But I realized, since I was working my way through pretty much, that this was the only way that I could manage. So there were a great number of things that I learned. I certainly learned my love for both the area of speech and dramatics as well as English literature. I was just talking with Dr. Murray last night about the course I had from him in Shakespeare and how much good it did me when I went on to take work in Shakespeare at the University of Minnesota, because I'd read a number of the plays and I could answer the argument, was Hamlet mad, you know, and give them almost chapter and verse, as we had discussed it in his class. Yes, there were many, many fine experiences, and I would say that what I had learned, for instance, in psychology, made my courses in educational psychology and things like that a breeze when I went into the university, because I'd had practical teaching experience, I'd had some good instruction, and the combination of the two made my grades at the University of Minnesota even higher than they were here at Moorhead State.
Why don't you talk about some of the people then from whom you had classes? Earlier, before we started taping, you mentioned a couple.
Yes. My first semester here, I remember very, very fondly. It was such a shock for a youngster coming from a small high school of around 70 or 80 students to come to a campus where there were 600 approximately, and a building that would swallow about three of our high school buildings that I had back there. I remember my first semester, Professor Ballard, after whom Ballard Hall is named, and that I think is an interesting touch too. It's great to get back here and see things like this. Professor Ballard was my teacher of human biology and health education, which I suppose is my biological science. Professor Berge was my professor of geography, just come from Clark University as an MA, new MA, and a splendid teacher, and I enjoyed that course so much. The other professor I had was Professor Archer, who was my teacher in Psychology 1, and he later went on, as you may know, to teach at the University of Minnesota. They were stealing people from this campus whenever they could find someone who was particularly outstanding, as they said. And then my English teacher was Ina Fogg, who was in charge, I think, of one of the residence halls, and I think she was probably Dean of Women, too, and I had her in English 1, which was not English 1 in a sense. It was really grammar. It was supposed to be grammar and composition, but it was grammar, and we went through the Kittredge Carpenter textbook, I tell you, line by line, and it was a rough old course, and a lot of people fell by the wayside, and I remember I got a C in that English course, and when I told my mother I thought I was going to major in English, she said, I can't understand it. You got three A's this semester and one C. Why would you want to major in English? And I said, I loved it. And it proved to be my right choice, too, as later on my marks definitely improved in that area, and that was my subject matter specialty. Mm-hmm. It was a great first semester. I certainly enjoyed that. I had other teachers. I was just looking at your campus map. I had a class in, I think it was in American history, from a Professor Bridges. And isn't mm-hmm. he the one after whom Bridges Hall
right,
is named?
Right.
And I had a class I had several classes from Joseph Kesey. He mm-hmm. interested me very much. I had a class in American government from him. And then I think he had just come back from Harvard, if he had received his Ph.D. already or not, but it was in the making at any event. And he taught us a class in economics, and our basic text was Thomas Nixon Carver's book on economics, who was his major professor.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great experience. Professor Murray was my teacher in Shakespeare, and he also was in charge of the newspaper, and I was news editor of what was called the Mystic in those days. Old Sliv Nemzik taught physical ed, after whom Nemzik complex is named, and then Georgiana Lohman
mm-hmm.
was in charge of the training school. And I don't recall having any classes from her, but I remember that she used to come in and observe my student teaching and would sit there writing furiously, and I would think, oh my goodness, is all of that wrong with me? And then at the end we'd have conferences, and I realized she was writing down some good things as well as my deficiencies. She, incidentally, was a very, very stately woman and a real leader, and I recall when I was teaching at Campbell, Minnesota on my first job, she was invited down to visit school, and she made it a point to spend over an hour in my classroom, and she gave me some very good suggestions during that first year that I tried to implement. Yes, those were some of the people that I had. There were just many good teachers, and I suppose the one that I had most contact both in and out of the classroom with was Ethel Tainter, who was the teacher of speech, reading and speech, I think the first course was called. Then we took advanced interpretation from her. I was in several of her plays, and then she used to put on little programs, I recall, of one type and another, and she'd oftentimes call me and say, well, I have to put on a program of so-and-so. Can you memorize such and such a selection and give it? And, of course, I never said no to Ethel Tainter because she was a teacher that I dearly loved. Was another one that I enjoyed very, very much was Maud Hayes, who was my teacher of world literature, and she had come from Oxford, and of course this was like coming from heaven itself to any little boy in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, was a very, very brilliant teacher and knew so much, and the course in world literature that she gave was truly an interesting experience. I remember also her directing of the Arts Festival and so on, and planning it, and her calling upon me to be the student business manager. And while it took a lot of time and paid nothing, nevertheless, it was a great, great learning experience, and I think Maud was the reason why. I remember when I played the part of Tranio in Taming the Shrew during my second year here, after one of the dress rehearsals, Maud sat down with me and talked about certain phases of the work, and we even went over some of the lines, and she said, well, now I think this would be a better way to say it, and so on. So those were some of the people. I'm sure I've forgotten some of the names, but there were many great teachers here at that time. There's just no doubt about it.
One of the great heroes of Morehead State is President McLean. He was here after the disastrous fire in 1931.
Yes.
During the Depression. You knew him before he was called upon by those particular challenges. What do you remember,
memories
of him?
I remember President McLean very, very well for a number of reasons, not only because he was very, very kind, but he was a director of many kinds of activities. I remember the chapel exercises that he used to lead. And during my second year, apparently I had worked well for Professor Leisure in the Building and Grounds Department in washing cars and mowing grass and raking leaves and painting in the boiler room and so on. And he said, President McLean needs somebody to be a right-hand man over at his place there to put on storm windows and take care of things and shovel the sidewalks. Would you like to do it? It'll pay you 40 cents an hour. Well, of course, I jumped at the opportunity. And I did that during my senior year. I don't know how pleased President McLean was with my work, but at least he seemed to think it was all right, and I think he wrote me a good recommendation when I asked for one, and he was always very, very pleasant to me, and I remember he took it upon himself to congratulate me, particularly the night of graduation, and wanted to shake my hand. I guess maybe he knew how much trouble I had in getting through. He was a great man. I think we all loved him. He was a very serious gentleman, and some people thought he didn't have much of a sense of humor. It was a sly, subtle kind of humor that Ray McLean had, and when he laughed, it was never the guffaw. It was always a kind of a sly little chuckle, and I think this was why some people didn't understand that the man really had an appreciation for a good joke, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Right. I suppose that in the 20s, which was a period of great athletic heroes, Babe Ruth and Jack Dempsey and all the rest of those, athletics was taken pretty seriously in that.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was indeed. I was, as I say, just such a youngster. I was 16 when I came, and I think I stood about 5'6" and weighed about 125 or 30 pounds. I tried to go out for football, but after one practice, Sliv Nemzik told me, well, he said, I don't want you to get hurt. Maybe you just better not try this. I knew I was too small for basketball, but I did manage to play some baseball, and that was my favorite sport. When you speak of Babe Ruth, the summer between, that is the summer of 1926, I had an opportunity to go east. So I worked in Detroit, Michigan that summer between my first and second years. And during that time, I had an opportunity to see the great Babe Ruth and Lefty Grove and all of the great heroes, Ted Simmons and Mickey Cochran, the catcher for the Athletics. I saw every team in the American League that summer while I was in Detroit because I was interested in baseball. And, of course, that for a young boy at that time, I was only 17. Why, it was a great privilege. I remember once in before a game, I saw Babe Ruth knock six consecutive balls over the fence in batting practice, and the seventh one would have been over the fence too, but this particular one hit one of the poles high and it bounced back. So those memories are great. Yes, that was a period of real heroes as far as baseball was concerned. We didn't have those heroes in basketball and football because they weren't professional sports yet.
Yes.
But baseball was the professional sport. And yes, I saw Ty Cobb in his prime, and he was a very wiry, fighting leader. It was an interesting summer.
Mm-hmm. The games between Morehead State, Concordia, what was then called AC,
yes,
North Coast State University,
yes.
Were they times of great excitement? Or?
Oh, indeed they were. I suppose you could say that the biggest football game of the fall for Concordia and for MSTC, as it was called in those days, was that football game in the fall. And the basketball games were pretty much on the same par, but beating Concordia was enough to win this. It was a successful season if you beat Concordia in those days. It was quite an affair because we'd play over at Concordia one year and at Morehead the next year, and of course it seemed that all of the Concordia boys came over here, boys and girls, and all of us went to Concordia too when we played over there. It was possible also to have some kind of inter-squad games at NDAC, that is Agricultural College, but that wasn't the rivalry. The mm-hmm. schools in the Minnesota League then were places like St. Cloud, and I think we played Mayville and Valley City, and some of Bemidji was on the schedule too.
Right.
It was pretty much a North Dakota and Minnesota Teachers College conference.
All right, you cheered in each other's backyards. Are there any other relationships between Concordia students and Morehead State students?
Well, I know some of them. I had gone to school in Hawley, Minnesota during the time I was in grades 2 through 6, and I met some students there from Hawley. I met a family by the name of Haugie, and the Haugie boys went to Concordia coming from the Reverend Mr. Haugie,
yes,
who was a director of Concordia College, and I knew them, and of course
Gabriel Haugie, of course, became a rather world-famous banker.
Yes, and Gabriel and I grew up together, and mm-hmm. and he was a year or two younger than I was. And his brother, Hawken, who was a couple of years older, was really an outstanding athlete. Gabriel, of course, was a great scholar and mm-hmm. A right. very, very bright boy. The Concordia gang didn't come over here very much, though. Nor did the MSTC gang go over to Concordia, but we visited them on those football days.
Right. You've been on the campus now for a week, and it's, of course, the middle of the summer. It's pretty hard to make judgments of changes, the physical ones you can see, of course. Weld Hall is still there. Wheeler and Comstock disappeared in 64-65, mm-hmm. And that's when the Center for the Arts went up. Old Main burned, of course, in 31, and was replaced by McLean Hall. And by Flora Frick. So the place has undergone a number of changes, even
yeah.
around the mall. So this is an unfair question. If I ask you, what has changed and what hasn't changed, do you think?
Well, I was going to say, of course, physically the campus is so much more beautiful now. It's so new, and I have been so pleasantly surprised by the newness of the thing. There's a couple of other things that strike me, though. there seems to be such a splendid spirit among the people that I've been working with here now. There's Dr. Myers is teaching the first course we have on Karl Marx, and then there's
Ted Larson is teaching.
Ted Larson, who's in charge of the movie section, and then there is Dr. Pemble, who's doing the ecology one. They're all such fine teachers and so dedicated, and that seems to me to be the kind of thing that I experienced when I came here the first time. I noticed also this tremendous job of organizing that Mary Ellen Schmider is doing with the group. Seems to take care of every detail. Our every want is met, and everything is so well organized and planned. And another thing that has struck me is how well kept the campus is. There's just no dirt around anywhere. There's no litter. And it seems that everywhere I go, I see people at work cleaning and keeping things in order. I saw some of the girls weeding one of the flower beds, and I said, well, if I had been here this year now, probably, instead of in 25, 27, it's the kind of work I'd be doing on buildings and grounds, too. Yes, I think the campus is so much more beautiful, and, of course, it's so much larger. The buildings are so much newer. The equipment is so good. I've been tremendously thrilled with the collection of movies that Ted has been developing, and all the other visual aids and kinds of things. It's just no doubt in my mind, Moorhead has really made great, great strides forward. And there's something else I wanted to tell you, and that is that there seems to be such a kind of a pride in among the people that I've met, and so willing to help. And as I walk across the campus, I don't know, the kids are saying hi and smiling to me. Maybe it's my elder hostel button. Maybe it's something peculiar about an old fellow like myself being on campus with all these youngsters. But they're very, very friendly, and I go into the place to eat, and the girl there tells me about her taking an exam such and such a day and finishing up a paper. And matter of fact, when I had breakfast this morning, she said, what do you suppose happened to me? I got an A in my exam yesterday. So this kind of thing, I think, is reminiscent of those good old healthy Minnesota days.
Well, you say we've made lots of strides. Talking to you, I'm not sure that we have. It seems to me that Moorhead State was always a pretty good place.
Well,
you talk about the kind of education you got and the kind of unusual teachers you had. I think it's very easy to look back and say, well, we certainly have improved. And I think, you know, you've been in education all these years. You know the kinds of improvements that have come about because more people have gotten educated and because there's better equipment and all the rest of it. But listening to you, it looks like the middle 20s weren't such a bad time for education either.
It was a different kind of a student body in those days, too. You must realize, as you said, how many kids went from high school on to college. Mm-hmm. It was a relatively much more select group, and I suppose now, with a higher percentage of people going to college, problems are quite different. At least this is what we found at the University of Kansas, where I've been a member for 29 years. We had many students who had problems, and while I suppose there always have been kids who couldn't read and write very well, nevertheless, it seems that it's a bigger student body now, and therefore you have a great deal more diversity. And incidentally, when you talk about improvements, if I were to compare the kinds of productions we had in Old Weld Hall compared to what you're doing now in the Center for the Performing Arts, where this a couple nights ago we saw Joseph and his Technicolor coat, you know, that was a superb performance. We never produced anything of that quality.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the equipment, and I suppose the talent either. It's a remarkable performance. I have seen professional theater all over the world, and in fact, I spent a whole week once in London visiting, hopping around from the Old Vic to one theater after another, seeing a stage play every night, and I don't know that I enjoyed any of them as much as I did the other evening over there in the Center for the Performing Arts. It was a great show.
Great, great. Well, I think we have talked about a great many things. I guess there's one more question I'd like to ask you. You brought it up yourself when you talked about the difficulty students have now in writing, and that's always been true. But looking back at your own life, you come out of Badger High School, one of 16 graduates, and you go down here thinking you're going to major in English, and you end up with a PhD in English. Let's assume that you were probably a little unusual in your orientation of the English language. You liked it, you loved it, you worked with it. But isn't it possibly true that almost all students then, not simply because there were fewer of them in a more select group, but because of their background, that students knew the English language better than they do now when it came to writing it?
Well, I don't know. I suppose to answer that question, like a good old hard-headed researcher who requires his students who are writing doctoral dissertations for him, makes them prove every line and makes them develop significant differences. I don't think that the kids are getting worse. As a matter of fact, I would like to believe, as good as the training program was that I received, I would like to think that the students that came out from my program were better educated than I was myself, mm-hmm. because I learned something, and therefore I could make improvements, and I've had advantages. Incidentally, when you speak about this from a writing standpoint, I don't know of any equivalent study that I could cite in writing. But I do know that a couple of my colleagues at the University of Indiana in Bloomington, Leo Fay and Roger Carr, both of whom are internationally known in the field of reading, made a very vigorous investigation of student achievement in reading during the period of the 30s and compared it with that of our present day by actually using the same examinations on students from grade to grade. And it was proved conclusively by their research that the kids of today are reading by far better than they were in the 30s. As a matter of fact, they would have estimated that the level is about a half a grade level ahead. The fifth grader of today is at about a half a grade level ahead of the average fifth grader of that period 50 years before, according to this particular research study. Now, we're talking about average children now,
right,
and a big, broad spectrum,
right,
and a very vigorous research study that used the best, most sophisticated means it could use to measure and compare.
Well, I said I had one question. Obviously, you knew I had two, but I don't have the second one, which was, why is it the students don't read so well now? You have emphatically denied that there is proof around.
Well, I'm
that
talking,
will show that may be true.
Yeah, I'm talking now about the ability to get meaning from the printed page,
right,
and to
right.
comprehend. I do think we have a greater number of things that are conflicting now. We didn't have television in those days. We probably did more reading. My students, of course, I believe that the library was the heart of the university.
Right.
And my students practically lived in the library in their spare time, as I did when I was here, too.
I came out of my office this morning at 1:30. My air-conditioned office, heading for an un-air-conditioned home, and a car pulled up, and two young ladies in the car leaned out and said, "Where is the library?" I think we end on that, because I'd like to make a symbol of that if I could, but I don't know how I can do that. Anyway, Dr. Oscar Howe, Professor Emeritus of English Education at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas, and a graduate of Morehead State, the class of 1927, has been our narrator. Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure.